ਵਾਹਿਗੁਰੂ ਜੀ ਕਾ ਖਾਲਸਾ, ਵਾਹਿਗੁਰੂ ਜੀ ਕੀ ਫਤਿਹ, ਐਂਡ ਵੈਲਕਮ ਟੂ ਅਨਦਰ ਐਪੀਸੋਡ ਆਫ ਦ ਸਿੱਖ ਰੈਨਾਸਾਂਸ, ਆਰ ਫਸਟ ਐਪੀਸੋਡ ਫੋਰ 2024. ਵੀ ਆਰ ਵੈਰੀ ਥੈਂਕਫੁਲ ਟੂ ਆਰ ਲਿਸਨਰਸ ਐਂਡ ਆਰ ਗਰੋਇੰਗ ਸਬਸਕ੍ਰਾਈਬਰ ਬੇਸ ਫੋਰ ਦੇਅਰ ਫਾਈਨੈਂਸ਼ੀਅਲ ਪਲੇਜਸ ਦੈਟ ਅਲਾਉ ਅਸ ਟੂ ਕੰਟੀਨਿਊ ਡੂਇੰਗ ਦਿਸ ਸੇਵਾ ਫੋਰ ਸਿੱਖੀ ਐਂਡ ਦ ਪੰਥ. Until the lions learn to tell the tales of their hunts, stories will only glorify their hunters. This ancient African proverb is a poignant reminder for us Sikhs to get our game together in these dark times and start collectivizing to write our own history to inspire and influence our future generations while defending the Panth to the death. Sikhi is a unique faith, a faith that is equally hated by all other faiths and states to the degree that they seek its dismantling by hook and crook to suppress it and drown it in the tides of modernity and liberalist-led secularism until it ceases to exist as the gurus envisioned and implemented it, and until it regresses into a demoralized sect of state worshippers thrust adrift on the wings of a fragmented existence. And what better way to disenfranchise the Sikhs than to insidiously attack their history, no matter how disjointed and how fragmentary these attacks may seem at the onset. This is not to say that Sikh history cannot be thoroughly inscribed or defended in the modern time. We have exemplars in the form of the Shri Gur Panth Prakash, the Shri Gur Katha, and even the Suraj Prakash for what it's worth. And there are multiple other texts we can use. But in a time where history is being weaponized by states and faiths, it is a negligent failing of our Sikh intelligentsia that lost in a deplorable fog of universal brotherhood or bhaichara, it is not locating more primary archetypes and evidence of the Sikh past to continue increasing our knowledge of our forefathers and their Sikhi. What is history for the Sikhs today, if not a force of discord to divide us from one another? We have hosted multiple historians on this podcast who have established and outlined the truth of Sikhi in their careers, but rarely is the information they have conveyed to us in the larger Panth ever mentioned in our sacred Gurdwaras. Rather, the false myths of other faiths and their obsolete rites are being practiced in the centers dedicated to the true Akal Purakh. The youth are divided as never before on the questions of the past, while boomer committees and boomer preachers continue misguiding them. We have witnessed a continuing battle between Ranjit Singh Tadriawal and the Taksalis of Jatha Pindra over the question of the Suraj Prakash. While we do not wish to take any sides here, there is some merit in Sabinderjit Singh Sagar's historical analysis of the Suraj Prakash that deifying any historic text as a sacred and sole source of Sikh historical and textual authority is only cause for unnecessary conflict. Sagar's text is available for free online, and we encourage listeners to download it and read its well-researched, evidence-based arguments. It is also rapidly becoming prescient in today's day and age that neither can we Sikhs trust many of the non-Sikh modern authors of our history. To reiterate Dr. Balwant Singh Dhillon's salient analysis of E.H. Carr's three principles of understanding history. Number one, always study the author and their times to comprehend their prejudices, for the historian is but a product of their times. History refracts through the historian's mind, but its light is filtered by the historian's own times. Number two, always study the text and its times to understand the era in which it was written and what the foremost concerns were then. Number three, always study the internal evidence of the text. And number four, in case of religion, ensure you compare the history to its religious scripture to confirm whether it synchronizes or not as a final checking yardstick. But it is also imperative that we preserve and have continued access to our original primary texts. Currently, we're witnessing advancing AI manipulation. It is not entirely unimaginable that those who are today digitizing Sikh manuscripts may have nefarious intentions and destroy original texts while altering their digitized content presented to us online. One need only ask Sikh intellectuals of yesteryear who are still alive how a particular Sikh academic based in the USA, and we will name him in the future, how he arrived in India in the late 90s to commence the digitization process, but refused to return several primary texts that it is rumored he destroyed and subtly altered their digitized copies online that we are currently using even today. We must think outside the box to preserve our heritage. The whole world may as well be against us at this stage, and we only have our innovation and each other for our weapons and our shields. The aim of this episode is to expose a non-Sikh historian whose notoriety is now infamous throughout the Indian subcontinent and beyond. A man whose father's diabolical interference with Indian history in general not only drove young and upcoming promising historians to disappear, but also caused unlimited bloodshed. This infamous historian is none other than Irfan Habib, a self-proclaimed Marxist historian whose intellectual depredations during the Congress era not only continued the depredations of his father, but also compelled the early demise of another Indian stalwart of history, the legendary Jadunath Sarkar. Habib, who today relinquishes an obsolescence during his younger days, was renowned for his political shenanigans that witnessed his silencing of any intellectual courageous enough to question his outright obfuscation and denial of both established and yet to be published historical facts. Marxist historiography's weaknesses are many, but the human failings of its adherents are accentuated by their agenda-based historiography. Prior to commencing our analysis of Habib's damaging of Sikh history, let us look at the rise of the Habibs and their eventual fall in the world of Indian historiography and Indian politics. Irfan Habib's father, Muhammad Habib, was a part and parcel of Motilal Nehru's Congress Party, having first come to public attention when he contested for the Swaraj or Congress-led Khilafat Party in 1926. At the time, he emerged as Motilal and his son Jawaharlal's primary strategic advisor behind the scenes, where the Hindu-Muslim communal question was being heavily discussed. In an era where Savarkar flawlessly attempted to rewrite the history of India to reflect a Hindu supremacist outlook, Motilal charged Muhammad with instigating academic confrontations to neuter the non-Muslim bloc in India, particularly the Hindus and Sikhs, whose sanguinary past with the Muslims was often exploited by political opponents to score points against Congress and weaken it. Could this question have been resolved in some other way? The Nehrus were no believers in utopia, even though they retailed it as an opiate for the masses, but more decisively, they were realistic enough to realize that even with the partition of the subcontinent, they would require a strong Muslim bloc within India to keep them in power. When their championing of the nascent Hindutva agenda, veiled in secular clothes, fell out of favor with the Hindu masses, or was hijacked by another radical and even more reactionary Hindu-led political party. But how to convince the Muslims of their intent and weaken the Hindu resort and the Sikh resort to the past? The Congress was aware of the Machiavellian role education could play in emasculating the masses if weaponized properly and proficiently, like the British had done against India when they had first conquered it. It decided to focus on the academic paradigm to weaken the Hindu hostility, and to this effect, installed Muhammad Habib at Aligarh Muslim University with exceptional powers and liberties bestowed upon him. And who was Habib Sr.'s first target the eminent Jadunath Sarkar, who was the author of a highly publicized and still used biography of Aurangzeb, delineating the totalitarian nature of Islam and the Islamic Caliphate and the bloodshed it caused throughout the subcontinent. His avowed opposition of Congress's Marxist historiography that reduced history to a matter of economics and resources, deflecting from human responsibility, fell foul of Habib Sr.'s initial targeting of the Indian past. Sarkar's work on primary manuscripts was debilitating to the Marxist historiography agenda, espoused by Habib, as they talked of a reality discordant with the modernist interpretation he lent it, often taking creative liberty of befuddling facts to reflect the fiction of the Congresside agenda. Sarkar, to his credit, stuck to his guns but was significantly outdone by Muhammad Habib, whose tenure culminated in the training of further Marxist historiography lackeys such as Satish Chandra and Nur al-Hassan, who were further tasked by their political masters with reworking the pre-colonial history of the subcontinent to reflect the Nehru's united secularistic envisioning of the past to meld the present they confronted. This utopian vision of the past the Nehrus and Congress indulged in, however, was beset by the inconveniences uncovered by Sarkar and also by the sanguinary past of the Sikhs, whose heritage comprised of rejecting the Hindu, Islamic and Christian offensives to convert them to their pernicious beliefs. Satish Chandra would attack the martyrdom of Guru Tegh Bahadur, alleging the Sikhs had constructed elaborate fictions around an event that was well deserved, as the Guru was a burglar, a brigand, and a mercenary. This was later amplified by American academic Audrey Trushke. We have answered her and her Islamist clique's intellectual offensives against the Guru in an older episode, Immortal Warrior. Hypocritically enough, the Hindu right copies these arguments while deriding their originators. The demise of Muhammad Habib allowed his son Irfan to succeed to his Marxist historiography mantle. A fervent worshipper of the Gandhi-Nehru dynasty, Irfan was awarded the chairmanship of the Indian History Congress multiple times, not for merit, but political sycophancy. His works imposed a chip on the shoulder of Muslim youth, reversing the facts of history to argue that groups like the Sikhs and Marathas had often unjustly persecuted Muslims to convert them for perceived offensives that the Muslims had never committed in the first place. Thus, while the Hindu right imposed the post-colonial construct of a monolithic Sanatan identity on the heroes of the past, the secular left, captained by Congress, rendered them the villains of history for its own electoral gains. In early 1991, Irfan Habib went openly on the attack against fellow historians and archaeologists who had been his loyalists once, Professors Gupta, Lal, and Grover. Their discovery of pre-Mughal structures in the Babri Masjid area, indicating there were prior non-Islamic structures there, if not definitely a temple. However, his fraudulent face was revealed to the world when the Indian courts ordered a total archaeological excavation of the Babri site. Much to his chagrin, other experts professionally validated the archaeological trio's conclusions. Still, true to his Marxist historiography mission and political sycophancy, Habib Jr. attempted to throw a spanner in the works by dating the discoveries. When an impartial audit was undertaken of his work, it was discovered that he was implying that the structures were from the 21st century and not the Mughal era. As witness number 70 of the Sunni Waqf board, Habib argued that the pre-Islamic inscriptions found in the ruins surveyed had been burgled from the Lucknow Museum, unable to provide evidence of how they were stolen and then planted in an archaeological site well guarded. His testimony was dismissed. Was Habib controlled opposition by this time? Did he join the opposition to accrue some favor? It seems possible, but over the ensuing months, revelations emerged that damaged his global standing and career. He was named as being the foremost authority on whose direct orders Jadunath Sarkar's works were censored for no reason other than he felt that they would instigate and incite communal tension, like what he felt about the history of Sikhs and other peoples who had confronted the Islamic onslaught. There were allegations from students of R.C. Majumdar that he had conveniently altered and interpolated Majumdar's The History and Culture of the Indian People with his alterations not found in older editions of Majumdar's publications, proving beyond doubt that he had been interfering with them over a whole decade. Then came a retinue of exposers that proved beyond doubt that he had abused his academic position and political connections to divest the taxpayer of thousands, if not millions, to fund his own personal projects and lavish lifestyle. But the more damning allegation that was proven beyond doubt and exposed his dark nature emanated from the family of his one-time student and keen defender, the late Dr. Parmatam Saran. Saran discovered and translated a manuscript of the Akbar era, Tariq-e-Akbari, but passed away prior to its publication. Habib shed crocodile tears over the death and informed the Saran family that the late historian's work was shelved forever. Or was it? 2 decades later, Saran's work was published under the name of Dr. Tasneem Ahmad with a foreword by Irfan Habib. By this time, Professor Arun Shouri was keenly observing Habib with his and his father's track record of blatant fraud having emerged in the public light. Shouri cross-referenced Ahmad's claims and discovered that the Akbar had originally been located by Saran and never Ahmad himself. Shouri, unable to access Saran's publication template that was with Habib, turned to the late doctor's family. Saran's daughter and son-in-law provided him with a facsimile of the manuscript given by Saran to Habib, the chairman of the Indian History Congress. This manuscript had Saran's original notes and signatures on it. Lo and behold, one of the most shameful episodes in modern Indian historiography emerged when Ahmad's published version was compared with Saran's facsimile. It turned out that Ahmad had removed the late intellectual signature, but otherwise incorporated his notes and passed them off as his own. We can now discern a pattern in Irfan Habib's academic work. Besotted with Marxist historiography, he established a precedent for subtly altering facts, but very cleverly by implied statements and by altering the works of others and then publishing them under his students' names as a sign of his favoritism, but also to escape any questioning. Marxist historians often rely on interpreting facts with a certain twisted agenda rather than mentioning them and underscoring their essence to argue for some modernist interpretation. But what if the facts themselves are blatantly inconvenient to their interpretations? The facts, of course, can be changed to fit their preconceived notions. Now we come to 2001, where Habib and J.S. Garewal, a Sikh historian, form an alliance under the aegis of the Congress government. Garewal, the teacher of Gurtej Singh IAS, has what may be called factual historical works, but often lent himself to mischievous interpretations that often opposed the facts he conveyed. Thus, discerning students of historiography boycotted him and his side dish, Indu Banga, for a while. His Institute of Punjab Studies was established with the intention of secularizing the whole Sikh historical outlook. Garewal should be appreciated for the facts he provides, but his onerous interpretations are often biased and unnecessarily detour into would-be scenarios. In 2001, Habib published Sikh History from Persian Sources with input from Garewal. The whole project was from the onset a comedy of errors lacking academic gravitas. In the introduction to the text, Habib thanks Garewal for providing him with Dr. Ganda Singh's Persian Omnibus of Sikh History, the Makaz-e-Tawareekh-e-Sikhan. This text incorporates the commentaries of other translators before Dr. Ganda Singh as well, such as Jadunath Sarkar, Irvine, and several others. Interestingly, Habib claims that he is unable to access primary manuscripts and is relying upon Ganda Singh's works. Despite the unlimited resources at his disposal as part of the Indian History Congress's budget, Habib's feigned inability only reflects his intellectual apathy and pernicious targeting of the Sikh faith and Sikh history. The Makhaz incorporates the Rampur Archives manuscript of the Aurangzeb era Akam-e-Alamgiri of Inayatullah Khan, the secretary of Aurangzeb. Habib's translation of the Alamgiri incorporates a certain line in parenthesis, literally kiss the imperial threshold, in reference to the 10th Guru's correspondence with Aurangzeb post-Kedaranna. Habib contends this is a direct translation of Ganda Singh's own words. However, Ganda Singh's own translation never incorporates this line. The same translation has recently been reproduced by Dr. Balwant Singh Dhillo faithfully in his work on Persian historiography of Sikh sources, and this line is nowhere to be found. By implication, Habib credits this line to Dr. Ganda Singh, but in reality, neither Irvine, nor Mukholiff, nor Sarkar, nor Gupta, nor Mehta, nor Banerjee, nor Kirpal Singh, nor Ganda Singh, nor Dr. Dhillo have ever referenced such a line, and these works extend from before Dr. Ganda Singh to after Dr. Ganda Singh. The subtle interpolation by Habib is to show the 10th Guru as being a quisling in front of Aurangzeb, when in reality, nothing like this ever happened. And although Habib then goes on to state that indeed there is no evidence that the Guru was ever going to surrender to Aurangzeb, the implication is clear by his insertion of a line conveniently designed to imply that further research may indicate otherwise. Other than the Muslim fanatic Muhammad Warid, even Islamist chroniclers themselves are agreed that the Guru was not one to surrender. Thus, the fact that no one picked up on this kiss the imperial threshold line in the past indicates Habib's subtle calumny and his success in getting away with it. Of course, you may say this is a one-off and an error, but let us traverse further. Proceeding onwards, we come to Habib's translation of Miskin's Tamasnama. Prior to Habib, Madhava Rao produced what is globally considered the most proficient translation of this chronicle. Rao mentions 50,000 Sikhs gathered on the eve of the Vadaka Lukara. Along with Sarkar and Gupta, he reinforces the fact that the Islamic armies carried out a wanton holocaust of Sikh combatants and non-combatants as per their Quranic tradition. He reinforces this interpretation with several contemporary sources celebrating the atrocities committed on the Sikhs. These are the Khazana-e-Amira, Tariq-e-Muzaffri, Tariq-e-Salatin-e-Fkhanan, Tariq-e-Ahmad, Tariq-e-Ali, Hussain Shahi, and Ghosh-e-Punjab. Forrester, a near contemporary, is also mentioned in his work cited providing the exact same numbers accrued from the eyewitness testimony of survivors and their kin. In his searches, Rao also came across the contemporary Rajwade letters dispatched to Delhi and beyond confirming the very same as Miskin. While Rao and prior translators to him and primary sources mention a number of 50,000, Habib baselessly extrapolates this to 125,000 without any explanation. Rao examined multiple manuscripts of Miskin's works prior to publishing his translation. Habib, he apathetically explains he only relied on the 1986 translation by fellow Muslim Muzaffar Alam, and believes that Alam's copy is authentic because it has a signature on it, a signature he himself has not authenticated, seen, or validated. So what do we have? A Marxist historian whose career was spent in infamy and notoriety, altering or attempting to alter the facts of history to conceal the sanguinary nature of the subcontinent's past and the boundaries between its communities for a political agenda. As for us Sikhs, isn't it amazing that in all the time we waste on helping those who would backstab us and have their own infinite resources, we rarely take the time out to see whether the historians writing about us are writing something factual or subtly distorting the narratives of our past? Where does this begin and where does this end? The Sikh youth must arise and reclaim their intelligentsia prior to doing anything else. Only then can we derive the true lessons from our past. The Habib duo's main grouse with Sikh history was its content. It ran contrary to their myth of Islam's peaceful adoption on the subcontinent and opposed Congress's agenda of secularizing Indian history under the facade of unity. But how could this unity be achieved if the Sikhs existed, a proud and defiant people empowered by their heritage and their past? The Sikh history was one of continued religious opposition to the infidel texts imposed by Islam, resistance to forced conversions, and the establishment of a sovereignty offering an alternative to the Islamic Caliphate. It was, and still is, a past attacked by multiple non-Sikh denominations, but the Habibs were more clandestine, more secret in their offensives. By making Sikhs doubt their own past, such academics aim to manipulate the Sikhs into devolving the contours of their own heritage, to question the exploits of their own forefathers and become mired in senseless and unproductive debates defanging their state-building and ruling apparatus inbuilt by the gurus. The Sikhs can only defend their history if they renew the vitality of institutions like the Institute of Sikh Studies or establish modern alternatives worldwide wherever they reside. They must return to tradition alongside being prepared to die upholding the tradition, but they must take care that they discern the intentions of non-Sikhs and even Sikhs themselves when allowing their history and their past to be published. Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa, Waheguru Ji Ki Fateh.